Hello and welcome to another episode of ACS Law Talk, a legal podcast presented by the American Constitution Society. I'm Joseph Jerome, a law fellow here at ACS. On December 7th, the Supreme Court decided to review two cases, U.S. v. Windsor and Hollingsworth v. Perry, or, in other words, challenges to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8, which revoked gay marriage in that state. The court's decisions in these cases will have a powerful impact on the future of LGBT equality in this country. Joining me now to talk about the future of LGBT equality are Professor Nan Hunter and Nancy Polakoff. They are both law professors. Professor Hunter teaches at the Georgetown University Law Center and Professor Polakoff at American University Washington School of Law. And they specialize in gender, sexuality, and the law. And today they've agreed to discuss how the law should develop with respect to equality in that sphere. So thank you both for joining me. Professor Hunter, let me start with you. So I was wondering, as a general matter, what are the core issues that these DOMA cases implicate?
Is whether a particular section of the statute, Section 3, is constitutional. And what Section 3 does is to prohibit the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriages, even those, or are actually only those, that are valid marriages. So in other words, a couple can be married, legally married in Massachusetts or New York or, you know, all the states where marriage is available now. But in terms of any kind of federal benefits or responsibilities or tax, Social Security, immigration, any other aspect of federal law, the federal government is prohibited from recognizing the legality of that marriage, even though the tradition has been that the federal government will recognize marriages that are legal according to state law.
Professor Hunter then explained basically what she thought both sides would argue before the Supreme Court.
And since the Justice Department has declined to defend, then that means that the this group basically representing the House Republicans will be defending the law. And I expect that they will argue that having this kind of explicit discrimination against one form of marriage is okay because it is the classification is subject only to a rational basis test, and any conceivable rational basis for the statute should be sufficient to uphold it. That I think is going to be their fundamental argument, and that will be met with a response from the plaintiffs that this form of discrimination, sexual orientation, should be held to some kind of heightened scrutiny because of the history of discrimination against lesbian and gay people, because of the disconnect between the characteristic of sexual orientation and any sort of legitimate qualification under these various programs, and because of the history of animus associated both with the classification and with the way that Congress enacted this particular law. So the court, you know, is going to probably the big question before the court is whether it's going to continue to be silent about which level of equal protection review it's going to use, or whether it's going to formally declare which level of review under the Equal Protection Clause should apply to sexual orientation classifications.
I'd like you to speak more about what level of scrutiny these DOMA-type laws should receive. While in Windsor, the Second Circuit ultimately decided to review these laws targeting homosexuals under the intermediate scrutiny standard review, that is, that the law furthers an important government interest and is substantially related to that interest, almost every other DOMA case has found that DOMA doesn't even satisfy rational basis review. So my question is there any conceivable rational basis even for laws that specifically target homosexuals?
Well, of course, that depends on who you ask. I mean, the defenders of DOMA point to Congress's, you know, that it was legitimate, argue that it was legitimate for Congress to promote quote unquote traditional marriage. They argue that it might save the government money by restricting marriage in this way, although that's highly contestable. And you know, they're essentially, what their real arguments are is that if you can even what their real argument is, if you can't even imagine a reasonable basis for this law or a legitimate basis for this law, it doesn't even matter what Congress actually considered, that any reasonable basis should suffice, because basically this, for traditional rational basis, we're essentially saying, look, unless there's something wildly out of joint here, courts should defer to legislative majorities and let democratically elected legislatures pass laws. So what has happened, though, in the last few years is that increasingly lower courts have either said, okay, this classification really kind of smells like some of the other classifications that we disfavor, like sex, like religion, like race, like national origin. And so we are going to have a heightened standard. Or they have said, you know, what the Supreme Court's really doing here, without saying so, is that they are really applying a kind of heightened rational basis. That is, they say they're applying rational basis, but it's not the same rational basis test that they would apply to a classification of people into, say, landlords and tenants. They're really looking much closer at the law and at the history of the law because of the animus that has been associated with these laws and the stigma that attaches to these groups. So we're going to use rational basis, but we're going to use the kind of rational basis that the Supreme Court has used. And that's really the distinction between the two Court of Appeals decisions in the DOMA cases. The First Circuit said, we're using rational basis, but, you know, we're going to use this other kind of rational basis, and we're going to just be honest about it. And the Second Circuit said, no, we're going to just go right out there and say that heightened scrutiny should be the correct standard.
So, Professor Polakoff, we also have California's Prop 8 case, which is the case, obviously, where by voter referendum they repealed marriage equality in California. So, why is this case important?
Well, the case is critically important, and the Ninth Circuit has essentially given the court a way to avoid the big question. The big question being, does the federal constitution require that same-sex couples be permitted to marry? In other words, is it unconstitutional to ban same-sex marriage, something that would affect the vast majority of states? So the original Prop 8 trial, the Perry case, after a trial before a federal district court judge, the federal district court judge said that Prop 8, not only was Prop 8 constitutional, but banning same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. But when the case went to the Ninth Circuit crafted a more narrow ruling. So what it said was, we don't have to decide whether all bans on same-sex marriage are unconstitutional. We are going to look specifically at Proposition 8 in California and at the circumstance that under California law, same-sex couples were permitted to marry and in fact had a right to marry according to the California Supreme Court. And Prop 8 removed that from the people of California. And for that, the Ninth Circuit said, we find no reason other than animus, other than making a distinction between same-sex couples and different-sex couples based on unconstitutional animus as opposed to some legitimate state interest. And the language of animus comes from the Supreme Court's decision in the mid-90s in the Romer versus Evans case, where the Supreme Court threw out a constitutional amendment in Colorado that prohibited any state or local government entity from enacting provisions against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And that amendment was thought to be so broad and to have no other reason than animus against gay people and was therefore unconstitutional. And so since that point in time, if a plaintiff is able to show that a restriction is based not on a legitimate state interest but on animus, that leads to a conclusion that it's unconstitutional.
Broad question, what's next for the gay rights community? I mean, even if everything goes the right way in the Supreme Court and the federal DOMA is knocked down, you're still going to have state DOMAs that effectively void marriages if you cross state borders. So I don't know what happens to those marriages, and where's the best road ahead? Is it in the courts or is it in the court of public opinion?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the secrets of the success, the relative success of at least the last few years of the marriage equality movement, has been that it has played this game, if you will, and utilized a strategy that incorporates multiple venues. So there will be lots more of everything, I think. There will be more action in especially state courts. There'll certainly be a lot of action in state legislatures. There's the potential to get up to, I guess there are about 30 states that have state constitutional amendments. And so there are about 20 states that don't, which means that in those states you could have marriage extended and the current statute repealed by legislative action. In the or by court action by the state Supreme Court. In the states where there are state constitutional amendments, there's no way to achieve the option of marriage for same-sex couples in those states except by either a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court or by the voters in that state repealing the constitutional amendment that they adopted, whenever they adopted it. So there's an upper limit to how far that effort can go. And what I would suggest is going to happen, at least in the near term, is that you're going to see that kind of polarization. I mean, we hear a lot of talk about polarization in American politics, and it's true, I think. And I think this is one of the hot-button issues in American politics, and so it's not surprising that there's significant polarization here as well. It's not surprising to know that the public opinion polling that shows increases in support for same-sex marriage, I mean, that's true, but the average is actually an average of very high support in progressive states and pretty low support in conservative states. There are a bunch of states where the level of support is below 40%. So I think you're going to see states like Illinois, for example, that have adopted a civil unions law, and I think it's likely that state will, in some point in the fairly near future, extend access to marriage as well to same-sex couples. And so there'll be more and more of those states that will, either with or without adopting a marriage alternative, will extend marriage. And then there'll be a whole bunch of states where I don't think there's going to be very much progress at all. So I think you're going to have a pretty divided country in say 5 or 10 years in terms of marriage access. And one of the things that's going to lead to are more and more instances of people moving around and litigation arising over whether the marriage that was valid you know, in Massachusetts or New York, or I think ultimately one way or the other, California or Illinois or these various other places, whether that's still legal when the couple moves to Texas or the couple moves to Florida. So there's going to be a lot of litigation. I think it's going to be a kind of mess, in a sense, and I think that's a good sense. I think there will be a kind of I don't want to say chaos, but a sort of quasi chaos in family law, which I think will illustrate, you know, the irrationality of having these different laws governing access. And I think the trajectory of that is to push and to pressure more states to extend same-sex marriage. So I think that's one dynamic. And the second dynamic is the dynamic that Nancy's been talking about, and that is whether states also create alternative legal statuses that are open to both same-sex and different-sex partners, so that all couples essentially have a choice. I mean, I think the goal should be that same-sex couples and different-sex couples have the same menu of choices, whatever that menu includes in a given state's law.
All right, Professor Polakoff, I mean, where do you think the gay rights community can get the most traction in the push for equality?
Well, I agree with the way that Nan has characterized what the future will look like, but I'll add to it that the achievement of marriage equality in a state shouldn't be seen as let's check that state off the list, everything's fine there for our families, and move on to some other states. And part of that is because of what I said before, that this movement for marriage equality, if you look at the rhetoric behind it, it has always talked about the choice to marry. If you tie every possible legal consequence to marriage, you aren't really giving people a choice. The couples who have the choice whether to marry are the couples in Canada, where before same-sex marriage was permitted as a matter of essentially constitutional law in Canada, unmarried and married couples were required to be treated alike for the vast majority of legal consequences based on a functional approach to families. So in Canada, if you're a same-sex couple, you do not need to marry. You are not forced to marry in order to have your relationship of financial interdependence recognized for all sorts of purposes. So those couples have a choice. When we're looking in the U.S. at the notion of a choice to marry, it's not going to look like a choice if it's a matter of economic or emotional life and death, whether you marry or not. And I would say that the trend of all these consequences that disturbs me the most and the fear that I have the most is in the area of parentage, in the possibility that, which we have now seen in some marriage equality states, that you have a lesbian couple plan for a child together, one of them gives birth to the child, they are raising the child together, and the state says, if you're married, that child has two mothers. If you're not married, that child has only one mother. And when we see that in marriage equality states, which we have now in Massachusetts and New York, I'd like to actually suggest that those children are worse off, that we have created a status of illegitimacy for children of same-sex couples that long ago ceased to be a status for children of different-sex couples. And if that's what it means to get marriage equality, that we're now going to create two different categories of children in that state, I think that's a very high price to pay.
Professor Hunter mentioned that, you know, we're facing an inevitable mess of litigation. So I wanted to see, do you think all of these issues are going to get wrapped up in the court system, or will legislatures start actually addressing these problems?
I think there'll be a combination on a state-by-state basis, because it's going to depend on what is politically possible in the states, and where there isn't the political possibility of any kind of recognition of any sort of families with gay and lesbian couples or parents, then the court is going to have to be the only venue. And one of the things we've seen over the years when it comes to children being raised by gay and lesbian parents is courts have generally been much more friendly than legislatures have, because courts are dealing with the real families with real children in front of them. And, for example, the whole area of second parent adoption has been almost entirely court-driven, not 100%, but primarily court-driven, so that you're not in a legislative arena debating the up or down of lesbian and gay parents. And that's just going to be true for lesbian and gay families across the board. Some things just cannot be done in the political process, and won't be able to in some states for a very long time. But there may be, in some states, a greater ability in the courts to achieve some protection for these families.
Well, Professor Hunter, any last words?
Well, I think, you know, I think that you can think about the next period, you know, I don't know, maybe the next, certainly the next year, with all of the, with the four ballot victories in November, and at least the DOMA issue being before the Supreme Court, as being an incredibly important year in terms of gay rights law, and specifically in terms of marriage equality law. And then, you know, somewhat, you know, ironically, if you want to put it that way, I think there will come a period, maybe it will start hitting in, you know, say 3 to 5 years, when you're going to see an intense focus or a lot of cases on that involve same-sex divorces. I mean, we've already seen same-sex divorces. It's not that they're, you know, never heard of, but just by the nature of things, over a period of time, that will happen. And some, especially as larger population states adopt gay marriage laws, then there's more likelihood of those individuals, you know, being mobile, moving across state lines. And usually the issue of the validity of marriage comes up in the context of a divorce. Maybe it will turn out to be a focus on, you know, state, you know, income tax laws or whatever, but uh-huh. You're going to start to see the beginnings of what I call that kind of quasi-chaos in terms of what the collateral issues are going to be after a significant number of same-sex couples marry. And so I think there'll be a big shift in focus to that arena of litigation, and that will take this issue into some of the conservative states that have state constitutional amendments. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens there.
All right. Well, Professor Hunter, Professor Polakoff, thank you guys so much for taking time to talk with me. Any quick predictions on how the Supreme Court's going to rule on DOMA?
I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I think they're going to strike down Section 3 of DOMA.
Thank you again to Professors Hunter and Polakoff for agreeing to speak with me. Gay marriage before the Supreme Court promises to be one of the biggest events in the legal world in 2013, and ACS looks forward to promoting a progressive dialogue on this issue. As always, theme music for the show is Brass Beat by Covert, available for use on a Creative Commons license. Thanks for listening.